You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras, the number one podcast for bow hunting product information and hunting stories from across the nation. And now, here's your nine-fingered host, Dan Johnson.
All right, everybody, it is Friday, one of my favorite days of the entire week, and that is because I get released for roughly 48 hours until I have to be back again to the cubicle life. But I get a chance to step away from that, spend some time with the family, focus on other things, and just really, I'll be honest with you, I'm looking forward to my nephew's first birthday party in a hotel swimming pool. That is what we're doing this weekend, and I'm going to cannonball the shit out of that pool until someone tells me, sir, you're splashing too much water outside the pool. That's my goal, anyway. And I'm going to totally dominate that birthday party to the point where my brother may come up to me and go, dude, settle down. That's the goal. That's the goal. And stuff my face with probably free pizza. If I had to guess, they're probably going to order some pizza. So that's my plan for the weekend. Hunting season in Iowa is closing shortly, so the late season plans, I'm going to start, once that shotgun season ends, I'm going to start doing some late season scouting, and then maybe set up on something. My hope is I can find a good food source, or I can find a good travel route between a food source, potential food source and bedding. And the only other thing I hope is that it snows a lot. And what that does is, you know, the trails, makes the trails more noticeable where these deer are coming and going. I can look at the tracks and say, hey, that's a big deer. And I could potentially set up on it. So that's the goal for late season. Nothing too outside of the box there. Get trail cameras up and maybe take a little inventory of what made it through the shotgun season. Other than that, nothing huge planned. Now, today we have a returning guest. We call him Dr. Mike. And he typically does product reviews, product comparisons for us on the podcast here. But today he is going to do a hunter profile podcast, and he actually has shot two really good deer for Maryland this year, and he's going to walk us through where he hunts, how he hunts, and he got one with a bow and one with a gun. So that's what today's podcast is about. But before we get into today's podcast, I know it's a dream of mine to head out west sometime and continue to hunt elk or mule deer or antelope or, other western game. And I know that for a lot of us, I'm putting the Midwest into the same category as the East Coast because we are so far away, it's hard for us to get out there and scout. So that is where an outfitter can come in, specifically Big Horn Outfitters out of Wyoming, Buffalo, Wyoming, to be exact. They're an outfitter for Western game, and dude, they do everything. Elk, mule deer, antelope, whitetails, pronghorn, turkey, prairie dogs, and then they even do some fishing trips as well. But I know Dustin DeCrew, one of the owners of the company. If you are interested in booking a Western big game hunt of any species, you guys need to reach out to Dustin DeCrew. Just look at his Instagram page and look at the success that he provides his clients. That is amazing in itself. But check out Dustin DeCrew and his partner. Let's see, what is his name? Rich Sweeney. And you can go to bighornoutfitters.com or you can email Dustin at dustin@bighornoutfitters.com or give him a call at 307 620-0390 and start planning for your Western hunt and tell them old Nasty Nine Finger sent you. All right. Let's get into today's podcast with Dr. Mike. All right. On the podcast again, we have Mr. Dr. Mike DiNapoli. How you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing great, Dan. How are you?
I can't complain. You have been on this podcast multiple times, but on more of a gear-related podcast. I know you've done a product review podcast for us, a couple products on there. You've done some product comparison write-ups. You've done a couple product comparison podcasts as well. But today, we are actually going to talk about you as a hunter and kind of do a hunter profile podcast on you because you have had one hell of a season so far this year.
Yeah, this has been my best season I think I've ever had.
That's awesome. And before we get into all the meat and potatoes, let's remind everybody, where do you live and what do you do for a living?
So I live in Westminster, Maryland, which is kind of probably northwest of Baltimore by about 45 miles. And I work in the emergency department. I'm a physician in a local emergency department here in Maryland.
Okay. Now, I don't know how much information you can give me, but my mom is an ER nurse. So she works second and third shifts at times, and she has some absolutely crazy stories, you know, about the things that can go down in an ER, especially at night. Now, with you being in probably a higher, you know, close to a big city, do you have any crazy, like, short stories that you could share with us about your experience in the ER recently?
Without a doubt, I think your mom's right. I think anybody that's worked in an emergency department probably has a long list of stories they can tell. Offhand, I can't really think of any that I could actually share at this time. I would have to definitely give that some thought. But, you know, without a doubt, there's a lot of people talk about the moon and probably barometric pressure and whatnot. But it is crazy the way that we see multiple things come in, you know, together that you just wouldn't expect. I mean, there's times everybody's coming in with shortness of breath, and that's kind of understandable if there's some, you know, asthma-related pollen or something like that in the air. But there's other times when things are just completely, you know, baffling how you would get kind of the same type thing coming in when really there's nothing you can put your finger on. And at some point in the future, if you give me some time, I'll come up with something and we can discuss it a little bit. But it's without a doubt, it's an interesting place. And, you know, I work as physicians, we often work different shifts. So there's times I'm working first thing in the morning, like 6:30, and I'll work till late in the afternoon. Other times I may be going in late in the afternoon and working till early morning, and then other times overnight. So it always makes it kind of interesting to fit in family and hunting and things like that with my kind of hectic schedule.
Right, right. And it is kind of weird because I have, you know, friends who are doctors or friends that work swing shifts, and they always try to plan their schedule, move stuff around so they get the biggest possible window to hunt during the hunting season. Do you find yourself doing that as well?
I try to do that. And you know, I think I'm kind of lucky from that perspective because most people that don't hunt are more interested in getting, you know, Christmas off and summer vacation off. And for me, if you give me a good shot right at the end of October and beginning of November, I'm pretty happy. And this year I got really lucky. Even without asking for it, I think I ended up getting like 8 days off at the beginning of November, like right in a row. Oh, nice. And that worked out really well and kind of enabled me to get out and do some things.
And I bet it helps with your paid time off as well. So, you can schedule, you know, you have maybe 2 days off, then 4 days on and 2 days off or something, you know, something like that. And then you get a big chunk off, but you don't have to use that much PTO.
Right. Right.
Cool. Well, you live in Maryland, man. Tell us a little bit about the terrain in Maryland where you hunt and the location within that state.
Gotcha. So, you know, Maryland varies a lot. It, you know, from over by the Eastern Shore, I think it tends to be much flatter, much more coastal. They've got a lot of crops and things over there. I have not done any hunting there, but I think they're supposed to have some of the biggest deer in the state or over in the by the Eastern Shore. There's a lot of agriculture. And then as you move farther west, it tends to get more hilly, somewhat like small mountainish, I guess. As you get over towards West Virginia, then you get into some much steeper mountains. And I live kind of in between that area. So the area where I am is mostly kind of some rolling hill areas. You know, it may go up or down a couple hundred feet, but nothing too steep or too unusual. You know, we're outside of Baltimore. I'm kind of in a triangle northwest of Baltimore and then almost straight up from Washington, D.C. in that area. And there's still a fair amount of farms and agriculture in this area. So, you know, they typically plant corn and some soybeans. And there's some kind of like little creek bottoms that run through those areas that can't be tilled, that grow up and end up being, you know, some hedgerows with some trees in it. And then there's also still some patches of, you know, undeveloped woods, which, you know, may have some houses break them up here and there, or just maybe larger tracts or something. But unfortunately, most of the, I think, larger pieces of properties are kind of slowly beginning to break apart and be developed. So it's kind of like there is in the rest of the country, you know, Right. Just the tracts of lands are kind of breaking up. And I think it gets much harder to hunt and probably much more difficult for animals and things to get along and do their thing.
Right. So how fast is that area becoming developed? I mean, there's places around where I live where I'll go a week or two without driving by them, and then I'll come back and they've got it bulldozed flat and a building up.
Right. Yeah. And it's definitely kind of gone that way a little bit here, because we're somewhat in the bedroom for Baltimore and DC. So, you know, people will live out in this area to get, you know, either more affordable housing or just to get outside of the big city type environment and then actually drive in. So it was developing, I think, very quickly initially when I moved out here, when the housing boom started. That was probably around like 2008-ish or something. And then lately it's kind of slowed off a little bit. So there's still some housing develops going up, but it's not nearly as much as it was when I first moved out in this area.
Gotcha. So how many acres out there do you have access to hunt?
So I have, you know, 14 acres of my own. And then, you know, most of my neighbors allow me to hunt on their property too. So there's a couple of smaller tracts that are about 15 and 20. And then there's some larger tracts too that are in the 200 range that, you know, are directly kind of around my area. But most of those properties, you know, other people are allowed to hunt too. So that, you know, presents a little extra pressure on those areas.
Right. So not only with, you know, I'm envisioning kind of like sub-developments, like subdivisions with like tracts of timber and maybe some ag in between. You know, and I'm putting this into a perspective similar to what I see when I go out to the western suburbs of Chicago. It's like there's development that's happening, but there's still some some undeveloped timber, like, you know, basically blocks of timber that the only reason there's still a block of timber is because the guy who owns it hasn't got the price offer that he wants from a developer yet.
That's probably a pretty good estimate, because I've done some hunting in Illinois before, and there's a lot of this area that looks a little bit like that. My guess is probably 75% ag for the area around me, and somewhere around 25 or maybe a little bit more as far as wooded areas. And where I am, I'm far enough out of town where the houses are fairly sporadic and spread a little bit apart. There's some areas where there might be, you know, 50 yards from each other, but there's other areas where it might be, you know, 300 or 400 yards or more between houses. But probably less than a mile down the road, there's big developments where you could literally throw a stone to your neighbor's house, and there, yeah, there might be 100 houses in, you know, a development or something. Where I live, though, the most of the big properties next to me are being utilized for farming and agriculture and kind of like fruit crops and things like that pretty well. And I don't expect any of that's going to be sold anytime soon. And that works out pretty well from on my behalf.
Gotcha. So what's the deer population like in the area that you live?
Right. I think it's pretty reasonable, but and I haven't done a deer survey, to be honest with you, and I haven't really checked anything with the state, but there's a pretty high amount of does. So my guess is the ratio has to be at least, you know, somewhere around 4 or 5 to 1. Certainly on my property, and just kind of the things that I've seen either on my trail cameras or in person, that would be a pretty good estimate, probably about 4 or 5 to 1. And there are a few big bucks here and there, but I think a lot of the, you know, my particular county out here actually allows rifle hunting. And then it's one of the few counties in Maryland that still allows that. So I think what happens is there's a lot of, you know, I guess average size bucks that get taken each year and really aren't allowed to get very big. Whereas a lot of the other areas that allow, you know, shotgun only or archery only, then I think those bucks are allowed to grow up a little bit bigger.
Right. Right. So how many years have you been hunting in that particular area?
I've been hunting here since 2004.
Okay. And have you seen,
although I have to admit that when I first moved out here, I did not hunt very much. So, I kind of was on a hiatus, and I was actually traveling more. So I was going out to Illinois and doing some hunting like that. But I really started hunting hard on my piece of property and the immediately surrounding area, probably only for the past 3 to 4 years.
Gotcha. So has there been a change in, even in the last 3 to 4 years, that you've noticed? I mean, has the herd gone down? Has it gone up? Have the quality of bucks gone up or down? Have you seen any type of trends?
So the one big trend that I've seen is, you know, I started really managing my property probably over the past 3 years. And before then, I would just go out hunting on occasion. You know, like I said, I was going more to Illinois and out of state and things like that. So for me, hunting here was just, you know, just kind of a way to get out of the house and into the woods and do something like that. But about three to four years ago, I was no longer traveling out of state. I was working and, you know, I had a family, so I was kind of staying at home more. And I started doing a lot more work, and I put in probably a couple of acres of food plots and hinge cut maybe a 2-acre area. And initially when I did that, I started putting out some trail cameras, and I would see some, you know, some, let's put it this way. I was getting excited if I saw like a, you know, a small 6-point. I was kind of excited because I really wasn't getting much before then. You know, and I'm talking something certainly less than 100 inches. I was initially pretty excited. Right. And on occasion, I would get an 8-point, and that would, you know, really be great. And then I did the hinge cutting and everything. And since then, because I was actually going back looking over my pictures over the past couple of years while I was getting some organized, and I really have seen a steady increase in the number of bucks and the quality of bucks. And, you know, I went from there to regularly seeing some pretty decent 8-points the next year, to seeing some bigger 8-points. I rarely see anything bigger than that. This year I've got, I had 1, 2, 3 really nice 8-points that would go probably 125 to maybe up to 150 on one of them. And, actually that's probably an exaggeration on the 8-point, probably like 140 or something like that. And then some really small 10-points, which surprised me. They look like very, very young deer, probably maybe 2.5 years old, and 10-points with, you know, tines probably no bigger than a couple of inches or maybe 3 inches. So I don't know what's going to happen with those. They definitely look young, and I'm hoping that if they get, you know, older, they're going to continue that 10-point frame and just put in a lot of size and mass. You know, only time's going to tell with that. But without a doubt, putting out the the food plots and then really giving the does a place to bed with the hinge cut, that has really changed things significantly.
So, you know, when you think of the grand scheme of things, you own 14 acres and you do habitat work on 14 acres. That's not a lot of ground. However, when you've done that, you said you've noticed more deer and better deer on your property. Do you think that is a direct result of the property management, I guess the food plot and hinge cutting on your part, or do you think it's just a matter of more deer are surviving because other hunters aren't killing them?
You know, that's a good point. I think it's probably a little combination of both. There's another property for mine, and you know, I probably should go talk to the people, and I haven't yet, but I've noticed some QDMA like signs posted on some of the trees that border their property, maybe a mile from here. So that property is about 100 acres, because I know I looked at it in the past. And, you know, if they're managing it, and then, like I said, there might even be some other people in the area that are also doing it, whether or not it's posted, that's certainly going to kind of recruit some decent-sized deer to the area. I know one of the hunters that hunts some of the adjacent land, he also seems to be, you know, more interested in, if he just wants to get some deer meat or something, he'll shoot a doe. And otherwise, if he shoots a buck, he's really going to hold off on a decent sized buck too. So I think that there's some of that's working. I think part of the issue is, you know, the orchard that's around my house. I think that, you know, they probably have some people that they allow to hunt there, and they may want to clear off as many deer as they're possibly allowed to, because the deer get in there and, you know, kind of, damage a lot of their crops and things like that. So they may be shooting more or less. I really haven't talked to any of those hunters very much. And then on my piece of property, I've noticed that I have a resident population of does. I probably have two, and they're probably between four and six does each. I don't know how they're squeezing into the little piece of property, but they definitely are. And I can recognize them very well. And then as soon as the rut comes around, there's literally a highway. There's kind of like a big path right in the center of my woods, and that forms a highway, and the bucks just go up and down that, just kind of scent checking does, I think, just over and over through the course of the day.
Yeah, that's good.
So I think it's probably a combination of both.
So that's good for you as far as tree stand locations are concerned. They take the path of least resistance, it sounds.
Yeah. I definitely had to learn to hunt it this year, because I think in the past I kind of invaded and went into the woods too much, and that was really kind of pushing some deer out of there and causing me some problems. And this year I have not gone into the woods at all, and I pretty much am just hunting the very outside edges and just trying to strategically place stands so I can actually shoot towards those paths or towards openings, and that's really made a big, big difference.
Okay. All right, so the work you've done, I mean, from your eyes – the work that you've done, adding these food plots and doing the hinge cutting, from what you see, more deer on your property as a direct result of that work, and that makes you happy. So my question is, has your goal ever since you've done that changed, as far as, because I know you mentioned, you know, hey, I got excited when I saw under 100 inch six pointer, and now you said you think, you know, you got trail camera pictures of 140 inch eight pointer, which is really good. So has the habitat work that you've done and the deer that are starting to frequent your property changed your goal as far as what you want to harvest every year?
You know, yes and no. I think the bottom line for me, and I've always kind of been this way, is, you know, for one, I just enjoy being out in the woods. So I just like going out, love seeing deer, whether it's a fawn or a doe or, you know, bucks, you know, great. But even an owl or a woodpecker or whatever, for me, it's just a blast being out there.
Right.
And my sole goal that I've always had since I started hunting when I was about 20 is, if I'm going to shoot a buck, then it's got to be a buck I'm willing to mount. And if I'm not willing to mount it, then I'm just going to shoot a doe. And that served me pretty well, to be honest with you. And, you know, I shot the 2 bucks this year, I'm mounting both of those. You know, I for me, that's just, it kind of helps differentiate for me. Am I willing to spend that kind of money to mount a deer, or is that something that really I want to pass on? You know, where does that fit in with my other deer? Is it bigger than my other deer? Is it smaller than my other deer? Does it fit in? Is there a story or something unique about that deer that makes me want to take it? And otherwise, I'm just going to take a doe. So, I mean, I've spent years and years at times, like 5 years without shooting a single buck. And then, like I said, this is the first year I've ever shot 2 bucks in 1 year. So that's kind of how I've gone through it, you know, pretty much since I started hunting.
Right. Okay. So you killed 2 deer this year. Were these deer frequenting your property throughout the summer months leading up to the, season, or did you have any previous history with these 2 deer?
Yeah, the one deer that I shot first that we called Goofy Horn, I've seen him. I think this was the third year that I've seen him, and each year he always had a kind of a double or split right main beam, which made him kind of interesting and made it actually pretty easy to tell him apart from any other deer. So last year I saw, I don't know, I haven't counted through them, but my guess is I probably had 20 or 30 pictures. I actually just got done looking at his pictures for this year before we got on the phone, and I actually had 62 pictures of him this year. And he was very regular. I saw him in velvet only once or twice in like end of June, beginning of July. And then he disappeared until, I want to say it was about October 14th. And then from then on, he was a regular customer. And once he came on the property, a couple of the other deers that had been hanging out disappeared. So I think this was, you know, probably one of the more dominant bucks on the property. And the other deer that I shot, I may have had some pictures of him last year or the year before. I'm going to have to look at him a little more closely. But I did get a lot of pictures of him at the end of June and beginning of July. I probably had about 20 pictures of him. And then he disappeared. And I would see him on occasion, but after I shot Goofy Horn the first year, then he became very regular, and I probably got another 30 or 40 pictures of him before I ended up taking him in the course of, like, I shot the first year November 4th and the second one December 5th. So in that 1 month period, I probably got an additional 30 pictures of him.
You think that's because of you took out the dominant buck and this other buck kind of moved in to claim his spot?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I see that. Well, when I used to hunt more, throughout the years, I would see a dominant buck get taken off a property and then almost like a power struggle, a vacuum, and all mm-hmm. these other deer would move into his area and, you know, not necessarily knock down, drag out fights, but establish dominance. To try to establish dominance over right. one of each other to try to take up his area. Cause obviously that mature buck is in the best possible area and, you know, other deer want to live there, but he's kicking them all out. So it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool to see that and witness something like that happen, whether that's while you're in the tree stand or through trail cameras as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think part of the reason that they really like the area is like I said, I really got that one area very thick with the hinge cutting. And then, I had a good number of does that pretty much call that place home, and I leave them alone. You know, if I'm going to hunt any does, I hunt them usually on the very edge of the property or something like that. And I don't go into that area.
Right. Now, before we started recording, we were talking about what we wanted to talk about on this podcast. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the hinge cutting and how that, you know, attracted deer to your area. So that's one of the things that contributed to your success. Now, on a small tract of land like 14 acres, you have to be very careful so you're not blowing deer out, burning up the spot, because you don't get very many chances at a mature buck on 14 acres if you screw up. So what were some of the other things that you did that contributed to the success this year?
So So a few things I did, you know, one, I think listening to your podcast and all the new podcasts that you brought in too, I think I really started paying attention to a lot of points that they made. And I think in the past, you know, I always kind of tried to pay attention to the wind, but you know, if the wind changed or something like that, or it wasn't quite right and I had a day off, I just was going to go hunting anyway and make the best of it. But this year I really made a decision that, you know, if the wind wasn't right and I had off, I wasn't hunting, period. That was it. I either had to find another place, or I just wasn't going to go in. And, you know, I tried to find some areas around the periphery of the property. So whichever way the wind blew, it was going to be blowing it away from the center. And I was going to be shooting more towards into the woods and whatnot. You know, so I think that's one thing that really improved my chances. And I really kind of searched the edges of the property, tried to find some trees, like I said, that would give me a place where I could shoot from almost, you know, any wind direction if possible. And then, like I said, if it didn't work out, I just wasn't going to go. The other thing I did, which really taught me a lot about deer and I think really helped me use this property efficiently, is I put up a bunch of wireless trail cameras. And, you know, the one thing I really like about wireless trail cameras is they go off and they will show you exactly what's going on exactly when it happens. You're not going in there, you know, we kind of talked before, you're not going in there and disturbing the area, which is, I think, important too. So some of these are literally like on the main deer trails in my woods and things like that. But the other thing is you really get a sense for what's going on. And I could literally, I think I've got 6 wireless trail cameras in this one tiny section of woods, believe it or not. And I could watch the deer kind of moving back and forth. And, you know, I would get a sense of, okay, the deer are moving today. Why are they moving? Okay, there's a cold front. The wind's coming out of the northwest. This is good. But then there was other days when, you know, the deer would be moving and it was a southeast wind. In fact, the second deer I shot during the southeast wind when it was drizzling out, which was, you know, a little odd. I wouldn't have really expected that. And you get a sense of what's making these deer move. You know, which winds are they moving? And when they move, where are they moving? And, you know, what about the weather? And what about the moon phases? And interestingly enough, this year I shot both deer on a nearly full moon, and I saw a lot of movement on nearly a full moon. And in the past, I wouldn't say I wouldn't hunt full moons, but I always preferred hunting, you know, a quarter moon or a half moon on either side because I saw better movement, you know, in the morning or in the afternoon. This year, I actually, on the full moons, saw a lot more movement in the middle of the day. And I actually gave up hunting in the morning, except on very rare occasion. And the reason why is my house sits kind of on the south side of my property, but otherwise kind of in the middle as far as east and west. And then immediately outside my yard, I've got crops, and then the woods are on the far side of that. So anytime I wanted to get to my tree stands, I would have to either find another way around, which I would try to do, or I would have to cross through those fields. So if I was trying to get to a tree stand in the morning, anything in those fields, I was busting out. And even if I tried to go around the fields, in the past when I tried to go around, even if I kind of ducked in kind of in a little drainage ditch and tried to sneak in there, what would end up happening is I would hear the deer, you know, likely does just kind of busting out of there. And I kind of learned my lesson. I said, you know what? I'm not going to go out there if there's a chance I'm going to get busted. I'm going to wait for them to go back to wherever they're going to bed. Then I'm going to go in and I'm going to wait for them to either do like get up and kind of stretch around and grab a bite to eat around lunchtime or something like that, or come out in the evening time and catch them going from their bedding to the food sources. And I think that really worked well this year. Right. And then, like I said, that in combination with the wireless cameras, one, on a day-to-day basis would tell me what was going on, but two, gave me a sense of movement patterns. And there were days that, you know, I would be at work and I would get home and I'd look at my trail camera photos and I'd be like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Like, you know, that deer was sitting underneath my stand all day while I was at work, and I couldn't do it. And then I'd go out hunting the next day and, of course, didn't see anything. Then the next day when I was back at work, they'd be moving. And eventually I kind of put all that together and I would wait. And if I was off, I'd wait and see what the deer movement was before I would go out and try to do anything that afternoon.
So this idea of using wireless trail cameras, man, I mean, some guys are for it. some guys are against it. Me, you know, I can't use them on the properties that I hunt for one reason only, and it's because I don't get reception mm-hmm. down in these river bottoms. So,
right.
So by default, I can't, you know, like I've tried using them in the past, and then now that wireless trail camera is just another regular trail camera. But
mm-hmm.
what would you say to a guy who is like, well, you know, using a cell camera takes the sporting out of it?
You know, it depends. And I think that people that haven't used them are going to tend to have that feeling more so. And you have to understand, it's not like I'm sitting in my office, you know, checking email and doing some things, and all of a sudden I've got like a bank of, you know, I don't know. I actually look at my cell phone. So it's not like I'm sitting there in my office. My cell phone starts going off and it's like, okay, that's the one over the southeast side. I just run out of my office, grab my gun and go down there, or grab my bow and go down there.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work that way, especially not on 14 acres. Cause you can imagine, one, by the time I see the picture, probably that deer's going to be gone. And the other thing is, you know, you can't really sneak in on a deer that well. I mean, I'm not saying you can't at all, but it's not like you're going to see him over here in this one spot, in this one opening, and you're going to be able to sneak in there and get a shot. Now, I will say, and we can talk about it later, the second deer I shot this year, there's a lot of truth like that. And that was a really strange situation that I never expected. So it kind of leaves me with an interesting perspective on things. But I was using my trail cameras more for just getting a sense of the movement and what's going on. I never sat in one stand and saw movement on the other side of the farm and said, that's it, I'm getting down and I'm moving over there. Because, again, you're going to kind of spook the deer off.
Right.
How I would envision using it is, you know, let's say you had 100 or 200 acres and you had, you know, a fair number of cameras out. If you saw that the deer were moving on the southeast corner of the property, you know, maybe there's in the southeast corner, maybe there's a cornfield, and in the, you know, northwest corner, maybe there's a soybean field. You see them all in the southeast corner by the corn. You go hunt by the corn for a couple of days. But it's a much more general thing like that. It's not like you're getting that intel right up front where you can just like go sneak right out and shoot that deer. It just doesn't really work that way.
Gotcha. All right. So the buck that you ended up shooting with your bow, and that was in November, right?
Yeah, November 4th.
Okay. So what was this buck doing? What was his travel pattern kind of like, and then lead that into how you decided to set up and eventually harvest him?
Gotcha. So both deer, interestingly enough, were like, I really played cat and mouse with both of them for quite some time, for probably a month before I shot each one, and was just trying to make the best use of that time. So with the first one, Goofy Horn, that I shot, I would literally see him, you know, sometimes in the day, sometimes at night, walking up and down the main path through my woods. And, you know, could literally see him kind of hitting certain cameras. And then if he walked all the way through, he would hit a certain number of cameras, but then occasionally I would lose him. So I couldn't really tell where he was entering and exiting. And that'll bring up an interesting point, which I'll get to a minute, as far as kind of how you have to keep an open mind, because I think my mind was kind of closing at a time. But I would see him kind of moving, and like I mentioned, I would be at work, and you know, I would get home and I'd check my phone, and there'd be all kinds of movement. So the next day I'd want to go move out there, and you know, I may not see anything that next day, and I would go to work the following day, and he would move. And it literally was like on a day-to-day basis like that. And I noticed his pattern is he would get on the property and he would be pretty constant for like a full day, maybe 2 days, and then he may be gone for a day or two. But he had to be pretty close by, because there was times literally he'd be there at like, you know, noon, and you know, he would show up in the mornings, be there through noon, be there through the afternoon, be there in the evening and things like that. So he spent a pretty fair amount of time, I think, on the property doing that. And then I started getting to the point where I was starting to pay attention to, okay, why is he moving on these days? You know, is it the wind? Is it the moon? Is it? So I started actually like kind of you know, not graphing, but kind of keeping a table of that information. And I found a lot of times he was starting to move on like, you know, kind of like what we'd expect, like a north or a northwest wind or something like that. But a northwest wind was hard for me to hunt because it blows in such a way down my, my property edge that the stands I was going to hunt in, that would blow it down into one of the two bedding areas. So it was making it pretty tough. So what happened is the day that I decided to hunt him, I was checking the weather, and the weather was going to be northwest initially, so I couldn't really hunt my property or the main part of my property. But then it was going to start switching around, and it was going to switch around to more like out of the northeast, which would have been perfect. So my plan was I was going to hunt the very west end of my property where there was a tree I could get into that it would not blow the wind into the bedding area with that northwest wind. But as it switched around, like around 10 o'clock, it was supposed to go more like kind of northeast. Then I was going to get down from that stand because the stand I was going to be in the morning was going to actually blow into the a different bedding area. And then I would just kind of move over to the main, back over towards the main part of the property. And what ended up happening is, you know, I was hunting out of that one stand at the west end of the property. And I almost never call and especially don't rattle because I just think that the deer almost in any area now, unless you're really kind of in a remote area, are probably used to hearing that. But I decided to give it a try because I knew that I saw the deer on the main part of the property the you know, the evening before, just as far as looking at the trail cameras. So I rattled a little bit and grunted. I had a smaller 7 or 8 point come in that morning, got some good pictures, and he moved off. And then I rattled and grunted a little bit later, again had a nice 7 or 8 pointer come in and kind of came right to the base of my tree, looked around, and then kind of like slowly moved off. And by then it was about 9:30 or so, and I started thinking, you know, the wind's getting ready to change. I'm going to have to get down, and I kind of gave it one last swing to my left and my right to see if there was any deer. And I looked down on my right and Goofy Horn was literally standing there on the little, on the path that I had walked in about 15 yards from me.
Wow.
And where he came from, I have no idea. Cause it's just amazing sometimes how deer can sneak in on you and you may not even hear them. And, he was standing there at about 15 yards, just kind of slowly moving along, kind of, you know, sniffing the ground. Seemed like he was kind of pretty carefree, to be honest with you. He didn't look like he was I'm sure he was looking for does, but he certainly wasn't too terribly excited about it. Didn't seem like he scented me. You know, I grabbed my bow and my plan was to, you know, move my bow over to the right side, but he was so close that I thought that, you know, if something happened and I was trying to draw on that right side and move my bow that he might, you know, he might see me and spook. So what I did is I decided to leave the bow on the left side. I kind of crossed my fingers and crossed my toes and just waited. And, you know, he continued down the path. He cleared that tree and I got ready to draw, but he was behind a kind of a bunch of like kind of brush and whatnot, where there's just a bunch of really small branches and things. And, you know, I didn't want to risk putting a shot through that. And luckily I stayed fairly calm through this whole thing. I don't know how I did or not. And finally I kind of looked around, I saw an opening in the branches and I drew back and I'm like, okay, if he makes it 2 more feet to that, I'm in good shape. If he turns and goes, to his right, which would have been the same direction the other deer kind of left off to, I was going to be stuck because I was going to be shooting like directly away from him. And he took 2 shots forward. You know, I kind of settled the pin on him and slowly squeezed the trigger and, you know, watched the lighted knock kind of disappear low onto his, into the left side of his chest, just behind his leg. And, yeah, I knew it was a good hit. He kicked up his legs and I kind of heard a little bit of noise and some rustling of leaves for 5 or 10 seconds. And then it just got quiet. So I was pretty excited at that point. I climbed down as fast as I could. And, instead of going to look for the arrow, I went home to get my kids because they were really, really excited because they've been watching all these deer with me on the trail cameras for, you know, several months, and they knew all the deer by names and they could actually pick through it as we were going through the things like, oh, there's Goofy Horn and there's Ace. And, you know, I knew they were going to be really excited and wanted to spend that time with me.
So the buck that you killed, you call him Goofy Horn. He's the mm-hmm. biggest buck that you've ever killed with a bow.
Actually, I shot a 10.2 years ago that scored a little bit better than him.
In Maryland?
But didn't have the mass that. Yes.
Okay. All
right. But didn't have the mass that Goofy Horn did. The other deer, I think it was a younger deer. I'm going to guess he was probably 3.5 years old.
Okay.
Beautiful symmetrical 10 point, but not a lot of mass. This deer had more mass, and my guess is he had to be at least 4.5, and I think the taxidermist thought he might even be 5.5 or more.
Awesome. So, you know, Maryland is a 2-buck state. Is it one with a firearm and one with a bow, or is it any weapon, two with any weapon?
So you can shoot one during archery, one during firearm, and one during muzzleloader. And they have a special caveat to that if you shoot two does, you can actually buy an extra buck tag and shoot one additional buck, which is what I was planning on doing, you know, hopefully during bow season or something like that.
So you can you could, if you wanted to, shoot 4 bucks.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
I don't shoot muzzleloader. I haven't done that yet, but I think you could.
Right. Okay. So what about, like, you being a landowner, do you get an extra tag because you're a landowner?
I don't know if you get extra tags. I could get crop damage permits, but those only pertain to does, is my understanding. Gotcha. And I've never really done it because my property's so small, it's not that big a deal.
Gotcha. Yeah, makes sense. All right. So you know, you got your kids, you tracked him, you found him. Now you just shot a great deer. Now, did your mind instantly after that, you know, after that day, did your mind instantly go back to tracking this other deer that was showing up on your farm, or was it just kind of you put him on the back burner?
You know, it's funny because I actually, every time I shoot a deer, I kind of take little notes and write like a little narrative just so I can kind of remember it or give it to my kids later. As I was going through all that, it was interesting. First of all, when we found the blood trail, it was unbelievable. It turns out I actually like literally shot him square through the heart. So it looked like somebody had picked up a 5-gallon bucket of red paint and just had like literally thrown it through the woods. Which worked out great because my kids and my dog were out following it and we had no problems at all. It wasn't like a tough thing. I think he went about 60 yards and we found him kind of piled up against a stump. And when I saw him, I had such mixed feelings because, you know, this is a deer that for 2 years I had seen him, you know, close to 100 times on my camera. I knew him, you know, by name. I knew him by sight. I almost got to feel like, you know, I kind of was a part of him or I understood him. And to see him there, you know, I think the first thought in my mind was, damn it, you know, I'm not going to see this deer on my cameras anymore. That's going to suck. Like, you know, it was fun. It was like so much fun, like seeing him there. Cause every time I would see it, I would grab my kids and be like, oh, he's back. Look, he's here today. You know, he's tormenting dad again. My dad was at work, you know, something like that. And we would laugh and we'd plan and things like that. And it wasn't going to be anymore. And, at that time, I think that's when I started thinking about the other deer. I was like, you know what? I wonder if that other deer is going to come back now that this one's gone. And literally about 5 days later, the other one came back and then he became the dominant or the most present buck on the property. And he started playing the same game. Like I would see him, you know, multiple times over the course of 24 hours, then he'd be gone for another 24 and then he would come back and, you know, I would be at work and then I would hunt and I wouldn't see anything. And, you know, we kind of went back and forth with that one for a while, but, it was kind of an interesting, just change in, I guess, emotions with the whole thing.
Right. Absolutely. Now the second buck that you ended up harvesting, did he do anything different or the same that the first buck did?
He was literally traveling up and down the main trail. I had cut a main trail through my property that, you know, originally what I had done was put it in there so I could access tree stands and, you know, bring in a feeder or bring in minerals and things like that. And I did set up some tree stands along that. But what I found is, I think by hunting in that center part of the property, I was really screwing myself over. And I think that's why I wasn't seeing many ducks or bucks in the past. But that path still existed, and that's what they were primarily using. And it was probably a little bit more to one side of the woods than the other. And there was a thicket off to the north side of that trail, and that was the 2-acre hinge cut. And then on the south side of that, there's a lot of kind of planted pines that had been there for a long time, and there was some kind of scrub brush and multiflora rose underneath there. And there was a lot of bedding around there. And then on the outside of that was where the crops were. And the does would bed in that. The problem I was running into is if I tried to leave the house and go to the stands by crossing that field, there's often does or deer bedded right on the edge of that field, which kind of made things really tough for me.
Right.
But right. But the bucks would cruise up and down that, because no matter which way the wind was blowing, they could get a pretty good sense of you know, what was going on. And then there was multiple trails that kind of crossed the main trail, because the main trail went kind of east and west. And there were multiple ones that would go kind of north and south through there and would, you know, allow them to either exit the property or to check some different bedding areas and whatnot.
Okay. So walk us through real quick the day that you ended up shooting your second buck with a rifle.
Gotcha. So what happened is, you know, I had been watching him kind of back and forth a little bit, and gun season was coming in. I'm trying to remember the date, but it was sometime, I think it was like the weekend after Thanksgiving or something like that. And it's in for almost 2 weeks, I think. And generally, I don't pay a lot of attention to it, to be honest with you. I use that as a chance to, you know what, I'm not going to hunt at all, and I'm just going to let everybody else hunt around me and push deer onto my property if possible, and just let it work that way. But what ended up happening is I was out there and I noticed on one edge of my property, right outside of my hinge cut, right out, you know, there's some trails coming out of my woods, crossing some other like little hay fields. And somebody had put like two big piles of corn right outside, literally 5 feet outside the edge of my property. And they were right on the outside of those trails coming in. And on a couple of occasions, on some of my trail cameras, which are close to the edge of the property, I would be able to see people like walking around. And the day that I shot that buck was really weird. And this is why I told you about how the trail cameras, it's interesting how they work out. And I could see where they could present opportunities that are potentially could make things almost unsportsman, I'll be honest with you. I was sitting in the house. It was raining. It was actually raining, you know, pretty hard. So I wasn't planning on going out. I was actually putting up some shelves in my son's room. And as I was, you know, I had my phone in there with me. I was listening to some music. And I got a couple of shots from my trail cameras that came across. And sure enough, it was this deer that we called Ace. And I called him Ace because it's short for asymmetrical for whatever reason. But he had really long tines on his left side, but he had a really short brow tine on his left. And on his right side, early in the season, he had a really long brow tine that was probably at least 7 inches, but had shorter mane tines on his bean. But he looked very wide. He looked like a really decent deer. But he broke off the right brow tine, that long brow tine, pretty early in the season. I want to say at the beginning of October, I started seeing him, and he no longer had that. But I started seeing pictures of that deer come up on my trail camera. I got like two or three, and I was like, that's pretty cool. You know, if I get a chance, I'll have to go either tomorrow or the next day or something. And then all of a sudden I heard a shot, and I was like, you gotta be freaking kidding me. So immediately although these deer are everybody's deer and nobody would have been doing anything illegal, I mean, still they're, you know, you get to a point, which I know anybody that hunts deer enough, you get to a point that they're like, you feel like they're yours. You have time invested in them. You got emotional energy invested in them. And I was pissed and concerned, to be honest with you. So I grabbed the rain jacket. I threw on a pair of clothes really fast. And I walked down to where I had seen him. And I looked, and I didn't see him. I didn't see anybody else. And, you know, I saw one of the neighbor's trucks a few hundred yards away. And this was a guy that I trusted. So I kind of walked over and I was like, hey, did you see or hear anything? Because I've had some people kind of showing up on my cameras that probably aren't supposed to be there. And he said he heard the shot, but he said he didn't see anybody. So we talked for a few minutes, and it was getting pretty dark. I think at this time, I think the end of legal shooting light was like 5:15 on that day, if I remember right. And this had to be about 4:45, so about half an hour beforehand. And we talked for a little bit, and, you know, I was probably 500 or 600 yards away from my home, so I started, you know, walking back towards the house. And as I did, I literally kept getting pictures of this deer right on the edge of the woods at that one spot. And I probably got 8 pictures. He was just literally standing there, and he would kind of just turn his head one way, turn his head another way, almost like he was kind of waiting, you know, for dark or something like that to get out. And I got back to the house, and as I walked in, I got, you know, one additional picture, and it was probably 5:55 at that time. And, you know, I showed my sons, and they're like, Daddy, you got to go out and you got to see if you can get that deer. And I was like, there ain't no way I'm going to get that deer. That's crazy. Like, by the time I get out there, he's going to be gone. I mean, it's nearly the end of shooting light. This is, will never work.
Right.
And they looked at me, they said, Dad, you got to go. And I was like, you know, maybe I should go. If I don't go, then I'm going to always wonder what if type thing. You know, you kind of put yourself in that situation. So I went downstairs, you know, literally just threw on a pair of camo jeans real quick and a camo long sleeve shirt. You know, grabbed my rifle and like 3 cartridges, and that was it. I didn't grab my backpack. I didn't grab any binoculars, like nothing else, because I kind of thought, this is ridiculous. This is just never going to happen. And I walked down there, walked, you know, right over to, you know, close to the edge of my property, where I didn't want to get too close. So I was probably about 100 yards away from where I thought he was sitting there. And I was looking around. It was really beginning to get dark at this point, because it was probably 5:05, and it was already raining and overcast. And all of a sudden, I thought I saw some branches, like, way over this hill. And I kind of, you know, threw my scope up, looked, and I could see that they were antlers. So I started kind of watching, and they're kind of slowly heading my way. And then I realized which deer it was, because you could literally see it looked like candlesticks on both sides of his head, one set a little taller than the other side. And as he crested the hill, I think he must have seen me, because I was sitting like on the ground at the edge of the woods. And he started heading like straight towards me, like maybe he thought I was a doe or thought I was something else, you know, something along that line. I guess it raised his curiosity. And then all of a sudden he stopped about 100 yards. And I was kind of looking out through the scope and kind of watching him. And, you know, by this point he had crested enough of the hill that I could see what was going on. And I was kind of watching him. I was trying to see if he would come closer. I thought maybe I should call, but maybe not. And as I kept looking at him, like, I could literally see it getting darker by the moment. As I looked through the scope, you know, it was finally at the point where I could see his antlers straight up. I could see the white patch on his throat, but I really couldn't see, like, much more of the rest of his body. I figured he probably was facing directly at me, but I couldn't tell very well if his body was off to the left or right either way. You know, I kind of decided I had to make up my mind if I'm either going to shoot this deer now while I can see him, because if he moves, it's just going to, there's no way that I'm going to be able to kind of reacquire him in my scope, and it's just getting too dark. And it was about, you know, 5:10 at that time. There's only about 5 minutes left. And, you know, I kind of decided I could see the front of him enough. I found the white throat patch, went down just about the bottom of it, and then slowly squeezed off the trigger. That was it. He just dropped like right there in the spot. You know, and then I ran over, took a look at him, and ran back and got my kids again. And, you know, they kind of helped me out. They were excited because they heard the shot. They were the ones that kind of instigated me to go out there in the first place. So they were kind of excited about the whole thing. And, you know, they went out, we got some more pictures and took him home and got him taken care of, you know, that night. So it was pretty awesome. But, you know, it's interesting. It's like I said, I never in my life thought that that would have worked out that way. But that was the only case where I actually saw a deer in a camera and went out and actually was able to make something work. One, you know, probably if that happened on a regular basis, then I would agree it's not very sportsmanlike. But I also think it's a very rare situation, and I don't think that's something that really would happen either on a small property like mine or on a big property very often, because I'd have to go back through things, but I want to say it was 30 or 45 minutes, pictures of this deer standing by this one camera for that time. And I don't think that happens very often. I mean, Typically deer are going to move around a lot more. You're just not going to get that kind of opportunity.
Right. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. But I tell you what, congratulations on having such an awesome year. Two really good deer in Maryland. And the cool thing is it's on your property. And I have a feeling that makes it that much better when it's on property that you own.
It does. I mean, it really, really makes it special. A couple of deer I shot out in Illinois are bigger than these two deer. But these are really nice deer for the area. And the fact that I started with, small deer, where I was happy to be seeing little tiny 6 points and, finally got these two deer this year. I mean, really makes me happy. It makes me proud. It gives me something to do with the kids because, they helped me get out and put in the food plots in the summertime and plant some trees and do some things like that. And, my oldest, who's getting ready to turn 8 in a couple of weeks, he's dying to go out there with me, and he's been out there a couple of times, and I got him a crossbow that he can use. So this year he's gotten an apprentice hunting license, which allows him to hunt with me, and it's a lot of fun. So he's getting into that. He's helped me clean these deer, and he's already talking about, Dad, let's go take a trip out to Ohio and go hunt some like public land, or let's go lease some land somewhere. And I'm kind of glad to see the excitement kind of welling up in his eyes.
Cool. Well, you've probably created a monster, but
yes.
I tell you what, man, congratulations again. Sounds like you have potential for maybe another deer this year, but regardless, you've already been successful this year. And I know, Mike, as we start getting away from the hunting season and we start thinking about gear more, we're going to have to get you on again and talk about some gear. Some bow hunting equipment. And until then, man, congrats again.
I appreciate it. And I think I'm going to try to get in touch with the guys from Land and Legacy too, and see if they're willing to maybe take a look at some aerial photos of my property and see if I can get some advice from them, or see if I can get them to come up and take a look, because they've got some some great ideas. And as good as my property is, I've got a couple of ideas, and I'm sure they could come up with even some more ideas.
And there you have it. Huge shout out to Dr. Mike for coming on the podcast and sharing his success story with us today. Huge shout out to each and every one of you for taking time to download. Please subscribe to this podcast, and you get everything all in one. The Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, the DIY Sportsman's podcast, the Transition Wild podcast, and the Land and Legacy podcast. And I tell you what, I'm working on getting more podcasts for you, not necessarily on this feed, but I'm going to probably start to open up other feeds as well. And that includes Western themed podcasts, waterfowl themed podcast, and fishing themed podcasts as well. So if you or you know someone who is interested in starting a podcast, whether that is a Western, you live out west and you want to hunt Western game, you're an avid waterfowl or an avid fisherman, hit me up. I'd love to talk with you about getting all that started and being a content provider for the for Sportsman's Nation. Hit me up if that's something you want to do. Huge shout out to all of the partners of this podcast: Wasp, Ozonix, Deer Lab, Exodus, Lone Wolf, Gearhead, Ripcord, and last but not least, Bighorn Outfitters. Please, with this Christmas season coming, it's already here basically, because everywhere I go I hear Christmas music. Please go out and support those companies, because they support this podcast. I would really appreciate it. And hell, they're all really good products. So take that into consideration as well. Go to Nine Finger Chronicles on Facebook and Instagram. Make sure you like that. Go to Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network on Instagram and Facebook, and make sure you like that as well. A lot more content coming down the rest of this year and for sure the beginning of 2018. I got the ATA show coming up in early mid-January, and who knows who I'm going to get on the mic then. Other than that, guys, if you are going to go out and you are going to go hunting, please wear your damn safety harness.